Show Me the Way, episode 14. Today, we're continuing our conversation with Denise Logan, author of The Seller's Journey, discussing the psychological elements of business deals. Before you jump into this, I would ask you to go back and listen to Denise's conversation with me, episode 13, to get a flavor of what has transpired before, what our discussion topics were, if you have not already listened to that particular episode. If you turned into that episode, you will recall us talking about those business points that everyone has to work through, such as getting prepared for and providing a financial stability into the future for yourself and your family. This episode, we will continue that conversation and dive straight into the emotional aspects of all transactions, what she calls the oh my syndrome, and what really kills business deals. And no, I'll say it again, it's not time, but many times it is time. It's just much more deeper than that. And I really appreciate Denise's help in walking us through that. So with that, let's roll intro music and jump back into where we left off the conversation in the last episode. To your point, again, another chapter of my book, I call it the Oregon Trail. The illustration, it was given to me by a good friend of mine, Tom Nolte, the architect, but he said, you know, here's really how it works in life. We're in 1848 in Independence, Missouri, just on the other side of the Missouri River. I'm in Kansas City, obviously. And that was a jumping off place for people to go west. And so people like you and I are the wagon master. And the ultimate reality is, say, I'm putting together a wagon train to go out west. I'm going to take people on a seller's journey. Would you like to come along? They said, no, I can pretty much figure it out. I don't need your help, you know, and I don't need any coach or anything like that. To which I go, well, okay, that's great. Now, you got to figure out where to ford the Missouri River. That's going to be difficult. Your oxen are going to need to eat something probably pretty soon, probably somewhere around the Platte River and up in Nebraska. And you're going to want to look out for those Native Americans because they really don't want you out there. And please don't get caught like the Donner Party did going over the Sierra Nevada mountains. And then you'll get to Oregon. Oh, by the way, did I tell you most of, you know, places are taken at this? But go ahead. Okay, you're probably going to lose a child or two on the way out there because it's very difficult. And there aren't a lot of places, restaurants, places to eat, so to speak. You want to guide them and put them in a position that they can win and help deal with their fears up front and not chase into this without looking at some of the details you're bringing to our attention today. And it's a journey.
And it's normalizing a lot of it. So I wrote a column, it probably came out around Halloween because of the title. It's called Scary Things That Go Bump in the Night.
That's not fair. You stole that one, but that's good.
It's about the things that wake owners up at 3 o'clock in the morning along the way of their deal. And they're like, oh my gosh, just like Michael, who am I going to hang out with? Or like the other fella who was, oh my gosh, I don't know my spouse. So we have very normal things. I'll give you another example of something very normal that happens. The very first time we poke at financials, an owner is filled with shame.
By definition, yeah.
Yes, and because they are used to being the person who knows everything about their business. And we are going to be asking questions that raise uncertainty. And an owner might be thinking, I don't want to look foolish. I don't want to have made a mistake. I don't know the answer to that question. All of the things that come up. So if we're before we even begin the process of poking at financials, if we are able to prepare an owner, you're likely to have this feeling. They almost inevitably say to me, I have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm like, I know. And it's not about having something to be ashamed of. It's about this emotional reaction that is likely to come. So that when it comes, they can feel it and they don't have to hide it. And we can talk about it. And we can say that makes perfect sense. Of course you're feeling that. And emotions show up differently for different people. So some might find themselves in a place of anger. Some might find themselves in a place of withdrawing. And especially if we have an unsophisticated person doing, I'll say an unemotionally sophisticated person doing the due diligence, they might not realize what they're actually seeing. So an owner might get angry or pull away. And the due diligence professional, the valuation person, might say, ah, there's something, and start digging like a hound dog into it, when it's nothing. It is simply about being present with the fact that as professionals, we go through this multiple times a year.
Yes.
Sometimes hundreds of times in a year. For an owner, this is, for most of them, the one and only time. And so much lays at risk for them.
It's such great insight, because I'm going through my mind all the times it comes up. And it's an effrontery, because they say they find something and it's like they're questioning their validity as a business owner. Don't they understand? Obviously, they don't understand this business. Why are they picking on this? This is not relevant. And so they take it as a personal attack every time.
But wouldn't you, right? I hear there's someone who I saw, there's a book about So Your Baby's Ugly or some kind of crazy name like that. And here's what I'll say. Would you actually like it if someone told you your baby was ugly? No, you would not.
Right.
And so how is it that professionals think it's okay to think that about difficult information that they need to communicate to an owner? And while I might have an advisor who will say, well, I would never tell them their baby's ugly, I'm like, that is going on inside that advisor. And the way they deliver information is with a sense of contempt and disrespect and disgust. And a person can feel that.
Right.
And so what if instead we recognize that we are delivering difficult information, difficult to hear, for the owner? It doesn't mean that we don't give information, but we do it with a place of care and compassion, as if our client was our favorite uncle.
Well, I can recall sitting here today going down this same path. It was about 6 years ago, only it was on the other side of the table. It was the investment banker. And I came in at the 12th hour because people were asking questions. I didn't represent the seller. I represented one of the shareholders. And I asked them, you know, if they did a quality of earnings report and what was their analysis of the company. So they put up a single sheet of paper as to their analysis. So I started, you know, questioning them, and they were offended. They also admitted later it was their first deal that they've done if they've broken off from a very large private equity group. And the way that I handle it, just in asking simple questions of the buyer, was an affront to them because they weren't prepared to deal with it. So it can go on both sides of the ledger. I was very low key. I didn't criticize them. I said, isn't there more? You know, what is that all that there is? And to your point, that wasn't very sensitive in dealing with, you know, the buyer. I really wasn't trying to attack him, but I did want to let him know that ain't the way usually I've seen it done. Now, to be blunt, not only did my client get a very good price, he held in there with a rollover equity and really made a lot of money next time out. So, you know, the good news is even through my little shenanigan, it didn't cost him any money, but it could be on both sides of the ledger. It's how, you know, you can't, I keep going. Is it the male ego that you have to watch because I'm reacting, or, you know, they're overreacting?
It is about emotion is what it is. And I don't think it's male or female. And I didn't mean to dodge that question that you asked earlier about whether men and women experience this differently. I think the issue is that we are all always experiencing elements of transition.
Right.
It's just that in the things that sometimes we are going through, we know them, we recognize it as transition. And in the process of selling a business, typically we are only focused on transaction. So let me just I have so many different paths that we could take this next
piece. Give me another example. Maybe you've got another experience.
So let's use a common example that we can all relate to. You're selling your house and moving to a new house.
Mm-hmm.
And you both like the house that you're leaving and you like the house that you're going to. But when you're packing up, all of a sudden there's like, oh, that's the tree that we planted in the backyard when our daughter was born. I have to leave that behind.
Yep.
We have some sense of loss, even though we're going to something totally wonderful that we like. And then we move into the new house and we realize, I don't know where the silverware goes in this new house.
And you're disoriented. Yeah.
Yeah, it's disorienting. And the dry cleaners is a little further away than it used to be. And I don't know where my favorite Thai restaurant isn't here. And we know those normal experiences that are happening and we understand them. And so we have some grace for our spouse or our clients when it's happening. The same thing is happening for a business owner, but they are going through it without the context of this being a transition. So for me, one of the experiences I had when I sold my practice, when I exited my practice and merged with this other firm, you know, they came with, this was back when there were still file cabinets and files, not everything was electronic. And so the other firm
You're
came.
You're going to have to explain what a file cabinet is to some of my listeners. But yeah, please go ahead. I'm sorry.
So the other firm sent trucks and trucks and trucks to take all the desks and the servers and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
And the last truck was pulling away from the building. And I wanted to see that. I was curious, to see it leave. So I leaned toward the window and boom, I smacked my head on the window. And all of a sudden, there were tears rolling down my face. And then I realized, oh, this isn't about hitting the window. This is about seeing the end of something. And in the weeks and many months afterwards, the first couple of days, I got to tell you, I was happy. I was on my porch drinking tea whenever I wanted, go for a run whenever I want to. But then things would come up. Like all of a sudden I would think, oh, I have to tell so-and-so. Oh, that's right. That's not my business anymore.
Right. Right.
And I had up and down. But the people around me, because no one really knew what was happening, were more like, but you got what you wanted. And so for me, I went through a period where I was like, I got what I wanted. Oh no, I got what I wanted. Wait, was that what I wanted?
May I challenge that? Because I always think in these scenarios, you're either running away from something or running to something. And I find a lot of times people are running away from something. And what I said, look, I've done it. Everybody's done it. It's not a problem. But for long-term happiness, I want you to run to something. And what I mean is, I think to make a healthy change, you would like to fill what is going to be a void with something bigger than what you were doing in order to have that, for lack of a better saying, a happy transition. Does that make any sense?
And even with something great that you are moving toward, there is the loss of letting go.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And in other times of our life, in other experiences of our normal life, we don't always rush people through the transition. We don't say, but you're going to something good, so get over it. Mm-hmm. Right? When our children are leaving middle school and they're leaving their favorite baseball coach behind to go to high school to the varsity team, we don't say, get over it. We're like, of course you're going to miss that coach.
Actually, that's not correct. As a child, I lived in 7 different cities. I moved around quite a bit. And my parents did say, get used to it. They didn't really give me a choice.
The angst.
Oh, the trauma. Yeah.
And the grief of it.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that I think we're going to be facing in this coming year, you know, the market conditions are changing. And there are lots of owners who have waited to sell.
Right.
Or maybe they entered the market with one set of conditions and are now transacting with a different set of conditions. And I think we are going to be doing work with owners to help them navigate a sense of grief that they may have missed the window, a sense of shame or regret, and that desire to hang on, like, well, I'll just keep it and hang on until the market comes back, which may be a longer period of time. And that may be longer than an owner has. And I think this is
to your point. Yeah.
Well, but this is a time for us to recognize that that is a normal process. And instead of trying to rush someone through a natural grieving process, there's a column I wrote a while ago called Grief, Loss, and Owners on the Brink.
Hmm.
And it's about what happens when we imagine our life will be a particular way and it is a different way. And I think we go back to my early life as a mental health professional, and the way that work and financial disorders and thanatology, the study of death and dying, the way those things fit together with this work that I'm doing now around exit and succession planning. As a culture, we don't really deal with mortality issues. We ignore them. We pretend that we can live forever, despite the fact that we will all leave our businesses and our lives. And often what happens is because we only focus on the money and the transaction part, when these existential moments of transition and change occur, unless we're prepared to address those and stay with the emotion of it, an owner will divert back to wanting more money or doubling down on working harder. There's something I call oh my syndrome, one more year. Oh my. And we'll often hear an owner say, well, you know what? I'm just going to do another 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. I can hang in there. Yep.
When I hear someone say, I'm just going to go 3 to 5 more years, what I know is there is an emotional element under there that an owner is unprepared to address. And they don't have language for it. And no one around them is presenting the conversation. Because 3 years is close enough that no one can accuse me of ignoring it. And 5 years is far enough away that whatever this mysterious thing is that's going on under there, maybe somehow it will work its way out.
Well, it's interesting because you answered one of the last questions I was going to have for you. And you know, what do you see for the market next year? And I'm with you. I think it'll still be robust, but it's pulling back. And pulling back means not the same multiples, you know, not the same cash up front, because I'm seeing more and more that specifically private equity groups are a little bit more hesitant because of the uncertainty with the economy to be as, for lack of a better term, optimistic about their desire to buy businesses. So the people who may have waited a little bit longer may find themselves in a situation that they will believe or make themselves believe that if they had sold a year or two or three or four earlier, they would have gotten a lot more money. How do you then deal with those people who say, I missed it?
So this is, we're going to have a little conversation about emotion here.
Okay.
Emotion shows up in a number of ways, but let's talk about the neurobiology of what happens with emotion. And I'm going to talk through a little visual representation that those of you who are listening at home can grab. Well, I'm going to hold up my hand and imagine that your hand is a representation of your brain. So the thumb is the amygdala. And that word, for those of you who like the spelling of words, is A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, amygdala. It is the oldest part of our brain. It's they call it the lizard brain.
It's way in the back.
And it's the oldest part. It's very instinctual. And the lizard brain, the amygdala's purpose, is to always be scanning the environment, looking for danger. So imagine that you've got your hand open and your thumb is just like a little lizard scanning, right? If when you were a little boy, you were threatened by a black bear, your amygdala would spot a big black dog and think it's a bear and signal you to run. So the amygdala is a helpful part of our brain, but it's kind of dumb, can't really distinguish between real danger and imaginary danger. So do this. Take your thumb and wrap it across your palm and bring your fingers over the front.
Mm-hmm.
You've created what a client of mine calls a girly fist, because no man would have his thumb inside his fist, they tell me.
Right.
So now you've got your thumb, the amygdala, safely tucked in, and these fingers represent the prefrontal cortex. It's the thinking part of our brain. So do this, Dave. Move your thumb around inside there. What do you notice?
I can't, or it's very difficult. It's being controlled.
It's very difficult, right? Because yep. Your thinking brain is on mm-hmm. and the fear is trapped. Now,
right. Move
your thumb around more aggressively.
Yeah.
What do you notice? Those fingers are not on quite so tight. The thinking brain is starting to go a little offline. If the fear gets great enough and the mm-hmm. amygdala gets activated enough, you will flip your lid. You literally, the prefrontal cortex pops off,
right. Those
fingers fly open, and now the lizard is running the show.
Right.
The reason that's important is because in times of uncertainty, uncertainty escalates the amygdala's desire to figure out, how am I safe? Am I safe? Mm-hmm. Danger, danger. So in these times of uncertainty in the financial markets, and certainly as we're even going through a regular deal, high levels of uncertainty are showing up for
Correct. Not
only the business owner, but their family and their employees and all of the deal team. So I'm going to give you just another piece of this that'll help tie it together. So using our hand again,
mm-hmm.
our hand is a good representation of how fear shows up. So there are five ways: fight, flight, freeze, fawn, F-A-W-N, and submit. So fight, flight, freeze, fawn, submit. Submit. And we will use all five of those different mechanisms, mm-hmm. all of us. But we typically have a pattern of two or three that are our go-to approach.
Right.
So for me, I will use freeze, fawn, flight.
Hmm.
And let me just play out what those are. So we all know fight, right? Put up your dukes. You're like mad.
Right.
You're arguing. You're combative. Now, fight. Flight. Flight is, I'm out of here. You know what? I don't need to do this deal. I'm out.
Yeah. Right.
Freeze. Freeze is, I'm going to overthink it. I need more time. I'm going to slow down the process.
Right.
Fawn, F-A-W-N. That is people pleasing. I'll get you those documents. I totally will.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yep. Up. All of that saying what needs to be said because you're frightened. And submit, if you've ever had a teenager in your house, you know submit.
Right.
Fine.
Right.
Whatever. Have it your way.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I've looked at the brain a little bit differently. I look at Cro-Magnon man at the back of the brain, what you call lizard brain. I have Einstein brain, which is up front. And then in between is monkey brain. And you're trying to figure out in any given decision or any given event, which of the three elements you are, and try to recognize it. In fact, sometimes you can feel that part of your brain, you know, firing off. I'm with you. And I think it's my hockey background. I fight. The gloves are off. You know, I'm going. But I fawn because I'm a people pleaser at the same time. And then sometimes I am in flight because I'm going like, I don't give a damn. I'm out of here. And those are my
And what
three.
Happens is this is, and the reason that I use this example, and I'm so glad that you contributed how it shows up for you, is I think it's important for every member of the deal team to know what your pattern is, what each of our patterns are, because they are going to show up.
Yep.
And when it begins, like because mine is freeze, fawn, flight. I know if I start people-pleasing or over-promising, I need to slow things down so that I'm not out of there.
Mm-hmm.
if we do this, and when I'm involved in a transaction, I do what I call an all hands on deck meeting. We all do this hand play.
Yep.
Because then we can say, here's what's going on in a deal.
That's good. I have not heard this before. Is everybody listening closely? Because this is the nut of it when it when I have what I call deal fatigue. This is what's going on.
Yes. Because here's what's happening. Emotionally, we are tucked, fully tucked in, fully wigged out all day long in all parts of our life. That's going on. Someone cuts you off on the freeway, and then you're using a different finger, not one of the ones that I described, right? Right? And all of a sudden, you're wigged out, you're back on. But in a process, in a deal process, emotion is going to be up and down, up and down.
Right.
And so, if what we're able to do is when anyone starts to get a little bit dysregulated, we do what I call pausing the content to address the context. The content is what we're talking about, the deal, the term, the financials. The context is what is going on under the surface. Somebody just got upset. Somebody just got scared. Instead of you getting angry and me people-pleasing,
right.
If we're able to pause and get our amygdalas down, get our prefrontal cortex thinking again, get our brains in and settle, create the emotional safety, we can then actually continue talking about the term. So bringing this back to the question that you asked me, I know that was a long answer, but
it was great.
Coming back to what do we do with an owner who feels like they missed the window and now their deal is valued less? We can simply tell them, well, that's the way it is. That's the market. Get over it. It's how it is. Or we can actually pause and say, this is super upsetting for that person.
Right.
Can we allow the emotional regulation to happen instead of just cramming through like, too bad, get over it. You got to get one. Because what we know is that it takes time for us to emotionally catch up to what our brain knows we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear professionals in the industry say, time kills all deals, I'm like, that's a lie.
Correct.
What kills deals is unprocessed emotion. Because doing a deal is much like the children's game, chutes and ladders. You know, in Canada where I grew up, they call it snakes and ladders. And I don't know who thought that was a better word than chutes. But we'll use the American version, right? So chutes and ladders. And if you remember that game, you like spin the dial and it tells you how many places you move your little token. And then you hit a ladder and you're up the board and you're like, woohoo, I'm going to win this game. And then two spins later, you hit a chute, you're back down lower on the board.
Right.
That is what is happening in a transaction. Professionally, we know that there are going to be ups and downs in the deal. For our clients, this feels like an existential moment. And their emotion is, unless we create the space and the people who can talk through the emotion of what is happening, they will want to flip the board when it gets too chaotic, whether it's a buyer or a seller or any of the members of the deal team. When we get emotionally dysregulated, it can make us feel like, forget it, and we want to flip the board.
Well, it's like I tell people when it gets to that point, I'm here's the deal, Custer. We're not at the little bighorn yet, you know, because I'm going, it's highly emotional. We're not at the point where we're going to get massacred or somebody's going to get bloodied.
But it feels like that. And if we come back to my early mental health training, remember, we're talking about something that feels existential.
Yep.
Will I look dumb? Will I not make enough money?
Right.
Will the people around me say I got taken advantage of?
Mm-hmm.
What will my spouse think? Who will I be if I'm not the owner of this business? All of that is churning up existential elements, which are likely to trip off fear. And if we're able to address that and keep normalizing it and stay with people through the emotional process, they will actually have a successful transaction. They will close and they will do it without being filled with regret and remorse. And they will land safely on the other side of this most vexing chapter in the life of a business owner, where they land safely on the other side and are fully prepared to step into their what's next. But if we as advisors do this in a ham-handed way, right, and we rush people, or we ignore what they're saying, or we don't invite them into really living into the emotional process that is happening, we cause harm. And you and I both know less than 1/3 of the deals that come to the market successfully conclude. And that is a tragedy, and we must change how that happens.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this is going so well, at least in my estimation. I'm going to invite Denise back to really enlighten us as well as entertain us, but to educate us on what we ought to be looking for in these transactions. I really appreciate Denise, you talking with us today. I know the listeners will as well at a very, very, very high level. I'm going to always remember my hand now. Okay.
It's always with us to remind us. What's
happening. It ain't going anywhere. You know, the three things you mentioned. So I'm going to have to work on Denise. So y'all bear with me, but we'll see if we can get her back for another podcast, because clearly there's a lot here to uncover and discuss. You know, all the points you've raised, I've seen it. And I can't tell you how many times. And would like to help people conquer this, because I've got deals in the work. There's going to be more next year. I'm going to look forward to having you back.
I will tell you that a lot of what we talked about plays out in the book. So The Seller's Journey is written as a business fable. It's the story of an owner 1 year after he exits his business. And he goes on a trip across Glacier National Park with his banker, his lawyer, his financial advisor, and the buyer who bought his firm. And some listeners might be thinking, well, that sounds like a murder mystery. But it's not a murder mystery. As they cross the glacier, they relate the physical obstacles they're facing to the emotional obstacles he faced in preparing for and exiting his business. And the little example that we did here about the hand and the amygdala and the way emotions show up are one of the examples that the characters play out in the story. So if your listeners are thinking, I didn't get all of that, how does that play out? It's in the story. And all of the things that we see are super normal and relatable in the book.
Well, I was going to say, to learn more about you, Denise, how do they find you? Where do they go? Where do they get your book?
My website is deniselogan.com. You can email me at denise@deniselogan.com. And the book is for sale on the website in paperback. And you can get it on Kindle or Audible through all the places that it's normally available.
Excellent. Denise, thanks again. And to my listeners, if you're in search of assistance with any of the topics that we've discussed today or in any of the podcasts, go to davidsider.com and schedule a free consultation. And make sure, please, to subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple. Thanks to Denise. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you next time. This podcast is provided for educational purposes, and it does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations of my guests or myself in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, please, business owners should consult with their advisors, with their attorney, on their distinct circumstances.